Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Different Strokes for Different Folks, to find common ground and take it to the next level with David Clark here on Blog Talk Radio. Each week, the show will encourage you to keep an open mind and prepare to open the door to new understandings. We will have an exciting array of diverse guests who will point up the fact that we are all spiritual beings having a human experience. Now your host, David Clark.
Welcome to Different Strokes for Different Folks, where we will be finding common ground and taking it to the next level. I'm your host, David Clark. I'm a spiritual adventurer, and I suggest you become the same. This show will indeed encourage you to keep an open mind and prepare to open the door to new understandings. It's my hope that you will come to see that despite our seeming differences, we're all basically the same. My guests will have differing spiritual belief systems. You may or you may not agree with things that are said. What I'd ask you to do is keep an open mind. This way, you can see where you can find common ground so that you can relate rather than compare yourself to others. Now, today, I have an exciting guest, a very courageous man, a gay man, a Metropolitan Community Church minister. His name is Chris Glaser. Reverend Glaser is the author of 12 books, including Uncommon Calling, Coming Out to God, Coming Out of Sacrament, The Word is Out, and As My Soul, The Blessing of Same-Gender Marriage. His most recent book is The Final Deadline, What Death Has Taught Me About Life. A graduate of Yale Divinity School and a lifelong activist in the Presbyterian Church USA, he was ordained by Metropolitan Community Church in 2005 and has served three congregations as interim pastor. As an openly gay candidate for ordination in the Presbyterian Church, he served as a member of a Presbyterian task force on homosexuality in the late 70s, as founding director of the Lazarus Project, a ministry of reconciliation between the church and the LGBT community in Los Angeles in the late 70s through late 80s, and as editor of Open Hands, a quarterly magazine for welcoming congregations in seven denominations. Since early 2011, Chris Glaser has blogged weekly Progressive Christian Reflections at http://chrisglaser, that's G-L-A-S-E-R, and again, Chris is spelled C-R-I-S-G-L-A-S-E-R.blogspot.com. Published on Wednesday mornings, the blog and subscriptions are free and ad-free. And please, folks, this is a man who is fulfilling a mission for God. There is not a lot of money coming in to support the cause, not enough. So please make donations. It will be a very spiritual thing for you to do. Glaser is available as a workshop and retreat leader, speaker, and preacher. He has been invited by hundreds of congregations, campuses, and community groups throughout the United States and Canada. Chris makes his home in Atlanta with his partner Wade and their dog Hobbs. For more information on him, go to http://chrisglaser.com. So with that said, I'd like to welcome Chris. How are you today?
Thanks, Dave. I'm fine. How are you?
I am amazing, and I'm grateful to say that I've been in this place for some time after having lived a life that had not been very happy due to a lot of issues that I've overcome through grace. So let's start off by talking about your first book, Uncommon Calling, which I read. It was given to me by my mother, who is Presbyterian. I was raised in the Presbyterian Church, and I was absolutely appalled at the church's stance towards gay people. Why did you write this book?
Well, I wrote the book really to tell my own story, but also to tell the story of one denomination and ultimately many denominations dealing with the issue of homosexual people in their pews and in their pulpits and in their leadership. And I was hoping that the book would help people understand this, my experience of myself as a gay Christian, but also the experience of many, many other LGBT Christians. And in fact, the greatest compliment I've received on the book is people, readers who are LGBT, who tell me, "You told my story." And then I also
yes.
wanted to tell the story of the Presbyterian Church as a kind of a case study of how one denomination has been dealing with it, and lo, these 40 years. And so I wanted to tell that story, particularly because of my opportunity to serve on there as the openly gay member of the task force on homosexuality that the church set up in the late 70s.
Well, I'm just curious. I'm long removed from the Presbyterian Church. I was a communicant in the Presbyterian Church. I kind of divorced myself from Jesus for many years, and I am now a devout follower. I believe in miracles. I believe in every miracle that happened in the Bible after having taken more of a metaphorical interpretation of it for years. But has the church, Presbyterian Church, changed its stance on ordaining gay people?
Yes, just a couple of years ago, in fact, it adopted a policy that permits ordination of gay and lesbian bisexual people. It doesn't mention transgender, but that has been an issue that has come up individually in presbyteries and congregations. But same-gender-loving people are now permitted to be ordained if their presbyteries and congregations choose to do so. It doesn't require ordination. And more recently, just last month, the denomination changed its position on same-gender marriage, permitting permitting Presbyterian ministers to perform same-sex marriages in states that permit it and in countries, obviously,
mm-hmm.
that permit it.
Mm-hmm.
And and then also changing the Book of Order so that it's a reference to two people making a commitment rather than simply one man and one woman, as it formally stated. So this is a big change. That the later change has to be voted on by the presbyteries, which are regional governing units. But the primary decision of the General Assembly, which passed by 71% to 39%, that was a huge margin, gave permission right away for Presbyterian ministers to perform same-sex ceremonies. Which is
that
a big
must
step
be,
for the Presbyterian Church.
Yes, I would say so. That must be very gratifying to you at a soul level to see that transformation having taken place.
Absolutely. And I have to also kind of wryly smile here because I've joked over the years of the movement that, you know, took the Israelites 40 years to get to the promised land. And so, you know, it might take us 40 years. And in fact, it did. It took us 40 years to come to this decision.
Well, it would have been better if it was 40 days and 40 nights, like Jesus' spiritual journey in the desert, but better late than never,
church,
right?
The church doesn't move as swiftly as Jesus.
Yeah, well, yeah, exactly. And we could talk about that till the cows come home, I'm sure. at any rate, let's back up. And talk about young Chris. What was your early religious training and spiritual experience?
Well, I grew up as a Baptist and a fundamentalist and a biblical literalist. And so I had several hurdles to jump to get to the point of accepting any sexuality as God's gift. You know, I was kind of raised on sexuality as something you didn't talk about it, and you know, you just, you know, didn't do it in the context of in a spiritual context. Gradually, I realized that my isolation as a gay boy growing up really led me into into a deeper prayer life with God. So,
wonderful.
Together for good. Yeah. And so that really piqued my interest in spirituality and my relationship with God and with Jesus and the Spirit and all things spiritual. But gradually in that prayer life, I came to understand that God loved me as I was, that God had participated in the creation of me as a gay young man, and that this was a good thing. And but even before I accepted that, I left the Baptist church because I was looking for a more open spiritual community, and I found it in a Presbyterian church in Van Nuys, California, and when I was in college, and it was that church that really helped me understand my sexuality as a gift from God, and specifically my homosexuality as a gift from God. And
how
I had already
wonderful.
I had already felt called to the ministry, so they endorsed me as a candidate for ordination, and I went off to Yale Divinity School. And I had come out to the pastor, but not to the session, which is the governing body of the Presbyterian church. And
right,
so I did that. I did that. And at first they were divided, and then ultimately they unanimously re-endorsed me as a candidate for ordination. And this was a blue-collar, white-collar congregation. This was not a campus church. This was not a of a particular class. It was really a broad spectrum kind of church that came to this place where they could continue to support me as a candidate for ministry. And then it went on from there, I mean, in terms of my growth and development. My parents, interestingly enough, who remained fundamentalist Baptist biblical literalists till the day they died, loved me unconditionally.
Uh-huh.
And
good.
They sought to understand who I was and what homosexuality was and was not. And they supported me from day one, even though they thought initially when I first came out to them, and this was when my final year of college, that I came out to them, they thought I could change. This was in the, the early 70s.
Sure.
This was in the early 70s. And,
okay.
But over the years they read things and they realized that this was, they accepted it as a gift and that this provided the content for my ministry, which then became about reconciling externally what I felt the Spirit had reconciled internally within me, and that was my sexuality and my spirituality.
Wow, that's big. Let me ask you a couple of questions, and then I want to try to relate to some of your experience, because my devoted listeners know that I'm gay, and they know what my own pain and suffering and issues in my past have been, which I choose not to judge. I embrace it as part of the process of becoming who I am today, and I love myself today, even though I was filled with self-loathing and shame. And a lot of that I blamed wrongly on the church and distanced myself for years. But I heard you talking about developing this prayer life where you were reconciling yourself around your homosexuality, and I'm wondering at what age that occurred for you.
Well, it happened early on. It was as far back as I can remember.
Really?
Important to me. Yeah, I would say, you know, before even puberty, before 12, this was always an important relationship. And for me, it was about when I was baptized, you know, in the Baptist church, it's a believer's baptism. So you can be baptized as a child or as an adult, but we don't, we didn't do infant baptism. I came as close to infant baptism as you can get in the Baptist church because I was baptized at the age of 6 or 7,
which
was very young. And and for me, what it meant was that I would belong to God and the church and my family forever. And so it was an act of belonging, and which really is what baptism is. It's a way of claiming us for one another as spiritual community and as a part of God's family.
Wonderful.
A long way. And what happened over the years was that, you know, initially I talked God's arm off. I would talk to God for hours at a time, and God served as both my therapist and my minister when I couldn't talk to a therapist or minister, because in those days only crazy people went to therapists, remember?
Yeah, right. Okay.
The minister would have condemned me. So it was, you know, so this was the one person I could talk to and feel like God would understand. And I felt God already knew, so to be able to talk about it was helpful. What's interesting is as I grew, I realized that prayer was more about listening than about speaking. And so I spend a lot more time in silence these days, and my prayers are very short, and my prayers tend to be the type where I lift things up in prayer and kind of review the agenda for the day, who I'm going to encounter, prayer, with family and friends, and for me it's, and this is true of Christian monastic spirituality, a prayer for the desert fathers and mothers was not about changing God's mind, but rather about your own transformation, because in the presence of God, you change.
That's right.
And so that's how I experience my prayer life today. It's a constant transformation. And of course, I resist.
Well, yeah, no, right.
Nobody likes change, you know?
No, yeah. It hurts.
Yeah, absolutely.
But that's because ego gets involved and fear. And as I heard Anthony DeMello say, wonderful Jesuit whose teachings I totally embraced after I came into recovery from alcoholism 26 years ago, he said there are only two states, fear and love. And anything that is not positive or love-based, anything that is negative, stems from fear. What do you think about that?
Oh, absolutely. And I love Anthony DeMello. I've used several of his books in my morning prayers. A professor of mine at Yale who became a spiritual mentor, Henry Nouwen, who's also written a number of books on the spiritual life, wrote about in one of his books how we have to move from the house of fear to the house of love. And that's the spiritual movement, and this is the movement that the world has to make. It's not just about us individually. It's about society, culture, the world as a whole has to move from the house of fear to a house of love. That's a large proposition, but a necessary transition.
Sure is. Well, you've raised all kinds of questions. Are you familiar with A Course in Miracles?
I'm not familiar. I know what it is, and I have it on my bookshelves, but I've only delved into it occasionally, and I certainly have friends who swore by it, and I've heard some wonderful quotations from it, and I think that it, from what I know, that it certainly was a response to the spiritual questions people were asking at the time that it was written, not to say that it doesn't still speak to us today, but I do know that it really is responsive to many of the concerns that we share with all people who consider themselves spiritual or interested in spiritual life.
Well, the reason I brought this up is getting back to fear and love. Of course, fear is ego-based and love is spirit-based, and the Course in Miracles talks about ego versus spirit and how important it is to shred the ego and stay in a spirit place. Now, I have been a student of A Course in Miracles, and it's interesting. It's composed of the textbook for students, Spiritual Exercises, 365 Days, and a handbook for teachers. Interestingly enough, the handbook for teachers is much easier to comprehend than the text. Did you find that to be the case if you delved into it?
I haven't compared the two texts, so I can't tell you, but that's interesting.
Right, no. Yeah. Well, yes, and, you know, the thing is it weaves the common theme, but it's not keeping it simple.
Right.
And the book was channeled by a psychologist who had been an atheist, and she came to realize she was receiving dictation, and she claimed that it was coming from Jesus, and I believe it was, because I believe Jesus lives in each of us and that we're all channels for Jesus, as you are you and as am I. So that's just a bit of a digression. I'd like to kind of back up and examine some pieces of your coming out experience. How old were you when you realized you were gay, and do you believe children are born that way?
Okay, let me just go back to the ego thing you were talking about. It reminds me of some of the writing of Eckhart Tolle, which I think is his writings are very helpful as well. In
yes, I agree.
How people interact, especially the concept of body pain that we carry with us, which
is
in many ways the same thing as ego, but it's this body pain that we carry with us. And I wish I had read that book before I did one of the interim ministries I did. It would have helped me understand why people were reacting the way they were to each other. But I like that concept a lot. But your question about what was the question about my coming out?
Just when you realized you were gay, how young were you, and do you believe children are born gay?
Oh, yes. From the earliest, yes, to my self-awareness of being gay, from my earliest understandings of myself, experiences of myself, I knew this to be true. I didn't know what it was, and I remember first seeing the word in an Ann Landers column. She was like a dear Abby at the time. Well,
I remember Ann very well.
And that was the first time I saw the word, but I knew what I felt already, and I believe that Chandler has done, I can't think of his first name, has done a wonderful book about summarizing all the studies about the origins of homosexuality. And I think that, you know, let me just be blunt, actually. In 99% of my conversations with gay and lesbian and bisexual people, they knew early on their sexual orientation, and they really believed that they were born. They believe they were born gay, and that's my experience as well. Now, you know, John Money at Johns Hopkins has done a lot of work about child development, and gender identity is fixed by about 2, and sexual orientation is fixed by the age of 5 or something. And I don't know whether that's still standard thinking in the world of psychology, but it's fixed so early on. And I used to say, and I think I may have even said in my first book, that I don't think God is over, you know, finished in the creative process with the birth out of from the womb. I think that you continue to be created, and so if it's something that develops in the early years of childhood, it's not a conscious choice. In the Baptist Church, we had what we call the age of accountability, which was the age at which you could make ethical choices. And certainly gender identity and sexual orientation is determined before that age of accountability. So it's not an ethical choice. It's just something that you are. And so it doesn't really matter if you come out of the womb gay or if somehow that's the developmental process, but it's something over which our choice is what we're going to do about it, and so that was the choice I felt faced with, and I really thought I was never going to be able to fall in love and marry and
really?
Anybody
wow.
like myself. Oh, yeah, the stereotypes that I was presenting.
Oh, yeah, I'm right there with you, Chris. Yeah.
So for me to recognize that one could be gay and Christian was really a spiritually transforming experience, and that happened
sure.
when I encountered United Church of Christ minister Bill Johnson, who was gay and ordained to the UCC ministry in 1972, and I
yes.
met him when I was 21 or 22, and this was
uh-huh.
the first one of the, among the first. I think this was the first gay Christian I ever met, let alone a gay Christian minister. And I was
go
so
figure.
Excited about meeting him that I set up my entry into seminary. I decided to go a year earlier than I intended because I just really wanted to do this, and I felt like it was time to do this, and I felt this very strong calling to be a minister. It just so happened I was also gay and Christian. And so it turned out that I was able to find a content to that calling in being a gay Christian.
Well, you know, I'd like to reflect a little bit on my experience, if you don't mind. I relate so much to what you're saying. I'm very passionate about my belief, my inner knowing that God makes no junk, that sexuality is a gift from God, that it's meant to be expressed with great joy. And the light bulb went off for me when I realized God could be present in the bedroom. But going way back, I was sexualized at a very early age because I was molested when I was about 2 years old by a man who I trusted, and, you know, it was confusing and all of that, and I didn't remember it until I came into therapy. But just to make a long story longer, I immediately knew that I was interested in the male gender. And when I first experimented with a little boy, who was a little boy, thank God, it was very exciting to me. However, I was horrified when I heard the word homosexual and the stereotypes of the day that went along with that. I could not relate to drag queens, pedophiles, all these lies. Nothing wrong with drag queens. I spent 9 years with a transgendered person who decided not to have a sex change and was a drag queen. And he now chooses to live his life as a gay man with no labels, but he enjoys expressing his feminine nature, and he has a female name. Now, backing up to the shame factor, the fear factor for David, I was petrified that I would turn out to be a homosexual. I wanted to be so-called normal. I wanted to marry and have children. That was my dream, and I eventually married a woman. I came out to her just before we married, and it was an experiment in a lot of pain and suffering for both of us. And I released her when I realized it was not fair that I had feelings towards men, and that was the direction I wanted to go. So I released her, and it was sad. It was very sad. But I did not hear, in your experience, shame. Is that correct, a perception?
Well, I did experience shame. I think that one of the shames of Christianity is that we do often experience shame around our sexuality. And,
no matter what our sexuality, right?
No matter what our sexuality is. I mean, I think that that's sad. I mean, that, you know, we're just even ashamed to be naked. And I think that, you know, that's bad, too. I mean, God created these bodies. God shaped these bodies and every body part, in my view. And so, this is a godly creation. My body is a godly creation. And so
right.
It's unfortunate that we feel such shame around our bodies. And it's not just limited to sexuality, but to body image, to
mm-hmm.
color,
to
ability, a disability, to everything about us that makes us not conform to what we think or what society may declare is the supposed to be the model of what it means to be a human being. And I think that that really is sad. I mean, I think we...
it is. It's a shame. That's what is a shame. No shame is good, but that is a shame.
One of the things that, you know, is missed in the Genesis creation stories, and there are two, but is that the one where God comes and walks with Adam and Eve naked in the garden, and they were unashamed. This is the original blessing that Matthew Fox talks about.
Mm-hmm.
This is the original blessing, and that we became ashamed of our bodies and our sexuality is, in my view, not God's doing.
Right. No, I agree with you. Yeah.
So, but I didn't know that. I mean, raised.
No, I didn't either.
Right. And a lot of the shame about sexuality, it also comes from the culture. It doesn't that just come from the church. The way we titillate people with sexual innuendo in images and you know, advertising and television and et cetera. C.S. Lewis has used the example, you know, what if we did that with gourmet cooking? You know, if we took a platter and had a lid on it and then raised the lid a little bit to some erotic music and gave a glimpse of the
food
and put it down. And then pull it up again, and of course now people do that on gourmet food shows. But
food is a sensual experience, right?
This is what you know. He compared it to stripping. That this is the same kind of relation that we often experience. I had a Episcopal priest friend who served in Latin America, who when he returned was just astounded by the comparison coming back to this country after serving in a more staid Roman Catholic Latin American environment. He said he hardly ever thought about sex when he was there. He's celibate, and he said he never thought about sex. But when he came back to the United States, suddenly he realized, oh yeah, you know, because there's so many, we're bombarded with so many images to get us around and et cetera.
Right. Well, there's a real paradox going on there and a lot of hypocrisy. Now, my listeners, most of them know that I have a history of sexual addiction. They have no idea how rampant it is, and it's shame-driven. I conservatively have had sex with over 10,000 men. And that may be shocking to people, but it's very easy to do in the gay world. And I judged myself as a pervert, and the more shame I felt and guilt because I could not be faithful to my long-term partner of 24 years, a wonderful man named Al. And then I went into relapse. I've been in recovery for sexual addiction on and off for 26 years and for the last 13 back on track. But I went into horrific relapses for 8 years and put myself and others at risk through unsafe sex. But it was driven by shame and guilt. And so I identified as being a quote-unquote sex addict. Well, today I'm recovered, not only recovered, healed through grace. I do not believe that once an addict, always an addict. I believe that is erroneous thinking. And for somebody to keep going to AA meetings, as an example, and say, I'm an alcoholic, they are affirming something that is not positive, in my opinion, in my belief system. In my inner knowing, I was an alcoholic, quote unquote. I drank a case of beer a day and sometimes a bottle on top of that. Today I can safely drink a glass of wine, and usually when it's offered to me, I say I'd rather have coffee or iced tea. So, you know, this is what I'm just going to put it out there. I have a book coming out that is going to perhaps rock the boat, but I think it will open people's eyes that addiction is really a symptom of dis-ease. It can manifest as a physical disease, such as alcoholism, or it can manifest in the case of sexual addiction. And I bring this up because you were talking about the prurient aspects of the society and how seductive that can be. And there is a high incidence of sexual addiction, especially among young gay men, who I know are out there having unsafe sex and actually trying to catch HIV because there are drugs available, and then they can have unsafe sex and not worry about it. I mean, talk about stupid. But I'm getting off the subject. What I was focusing in on was shame and how toxic that can be, and just sharing a little bit of my experience. Do you have any comments on that subject before we move on?
Well, I think shame is a driving factor in any kind of addiction. And I've got to just say, though, that what may be true for you, it may not be true for all people in 12-step programs.
I agree, Chris.
Those are meeting a need, and that is a spiritual community. I sometimes kid the church. If they want to know where spirituality went, they should just go down to their church basements and meet with the 12-step
mm-hmm.
program that's down there.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's where people are vulnerable with each other, where they tell their stories. I wish we could do more
yes.
of that in church. And,
oh, yes.
And
very spiritual.
I do understand what you're saying about, saying always I'm an alcoholic and therefore da-da-da. Because it reminds me of a book by a writer in Celtic spirituality, Philip Newell, who's a Church of Scotland minister, who says, he doesn't like to go to church and every Sunday say this prayer of confession. He said it's like beginning to make love to my wife, and with a disclaimer about what a rotten person I am, part two. And I think that there's some truth to that. And AA 12-step was based on a kind of Christian model and this need
mm-hmm.
for confession.
Yes.
And I do think
yes.
confession
yes.
is important and helpful.
Yes.
I think I would have been helped if I had been reared Roman Catholic and they were able to go to a priest and confess and talk
mm-hmm.
about it with
mm-hmm.
somebody. But I didn't have that experience. So I think that as your program is, different strokes for different folks. And some people
right.
find different spiritual experiences meaningful. For some it's 12-step, for some it's church, for some it's a prayer of confession,
mm-hmm.
for others it's a prayer for deliverance. I like to substitute a prayer for deliverance sometimes when I'm leading a worship service, rather than because there are many things we need to be delivered from. Deliver us from evil, the Lord's Prayer goes. And I think that there are many... So that's sometimes what I substitute rather than just simply a prayer of confession. I remember a woman in seminary who said, that most prayers of confession were about misuses, abuses of power. She said, what I need to confess is that I have not taken my power seriously, that I haven't asserted my power. I haven't asserted
Oh, yeah.
And,
All right.
We have different things that we need to confess and recognize as limiting us from the being the full children of God that we are.
Very good. I just want to make it clear I'm not knocking 12-step programs because I believe they saved my life. I mean, I have attempted suicide, blah, 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 blah. And I believe that Bill Wilson, who was one of the founders of Alcoholics Anonymous, was a channel for God, that it was a God-inspired program and perhaps the greatest gift from God to the 20th century. And I understand the reason to identify as an alcoholic in the beginning to overcome denial. Denial is not just a river in Egypt. However, for me, it became dysfunctional over the years to affirm that I was an alcoholic and very dysfunctional to affirm that I was a sex addict. And I would have people rolling their eyeballs in meetings when I first started saying, I'm sexually sober, and later saying, I'm a free spirit. I would no longer identify with the disease because I was free of it. But, you know, that, again, I appreciate what you were saying, that it's all a matter of perspective. What works for one does not work for another. I am entitled to my beliefs, as are others, and I'm not going to knock them at all. 12-step programs, I still go to them. I find a lot of spiritual fruit from them. I don't agree with everything that's said, but I go to meetings today not just for my spirit, but my spirit is greatly enhanced by the testimony that I give that can help newcomers and the people that I sponsor in 12-step programs.
Thanks, David. You know, you mentioned that you had a couple of callers. Do you want to take some of those now?
Well, I would love to, but they haven't called in.
Well, I'll be darned.
I know. Well, let me just put it out there,
I feel like Frasier on a bad day on his talk show.
No. Don't feel bad about it. You know who calls?
I'm kidding.
Yeah, I know you are. But at least that's where I thought you were coming from. The shows I get the callers on are psychics and healers, and I quite frankly don't understand that, although I did get some callers for a dynamic lesbian minister. And I'm going to have to kind of make the title for your next show a little edgier, I think. And maybe you can help me with that later. But, folks, Chris Glaser is going to return on July 30th July 31st. Well, I've got it down for July 30th, but let's talk about that later. We can certainly do it on the 31st. I'll just flip-flop my schedule because most of the folks that I deal with are very flexible, and so we'll talk about that later. But my point is this. He's going to return the end of July, and all you have to do is search Blog Talk Radio to find the date. And please, please, this is a man who has a lot of wisdom, a lot of love in his heart, a lot of experience, strength, and hope. And I'm sure that if people are troubled at a spiritual level, however that may manifest in their life, this is a man who will be able to help you. So please call in. We're going to do a special edition of the show and extend it for almost 2 hours. And so Chris will be back in about 3 weeks. Chris, we're not going to be able to cover all the ground I wanted to for today, but this has been very, very fascinating and illuminating, and I thank you for going with the flow. Let me ask you, what was your early concept of God? Was he judgmental or loving?
Well, I think my early concepts of God were all biblically based, and, you know, you certainly have the God of judgment as it's presented in most churches in the Hebrew Scriptures, which isn't quite accurate because the Hebrew Scriptures keep saying this is a God of mercy and righteousness and compassion. And, you know, it's not all one way in Hebrew Scriptures, and it was really a mistaken notion to think of that kind of God. But you do have a God that originated as a nationalist deity, you know, that morphed into a more universal deity, one that the prophets, the Hebrew prophets, said was the God of all people, and that everyone was welcome in God's house, which is universalism that is so important. My experience of God, frankly, was like many children's experience of God. I think it's, you know, kind of a grandfatherly type up in the clouds somewhere.
Yes, right.
And
right.
Always above, up in heaven. And judging but loving someone I could talk to. And someone I often ask forgiveness from if I thought a bad thought. And I was raised in a Fundamentalist Christian School, which is still around, Village Christian School, as a matter of fact. I was raised in that. My mother taught first grade there most of her teaching career, and I attended there from first grade through ninth grade. And so Christianity was pretty much inculcated into me, and all those various views of God were there. I think my view of God today is, I just finished reading the anonymous 14th century monk's book, The Cloud of Unknowing.
And, oh, I love that title.
I really claim that because I think the as I grow older, the less I really know about God. I've let go of a lot of understandings about God and realized my ignorance when it comes to who God is. I still believe in God. I still pray. I still believe God touches me in my morning prayer, and I don't mean physically, but also physically.
Right.
I mean, and I believe in a God that is embodied in what we see. That I became enamored in college of process theology, which really saw it was not pantheistic, where the world is God, but it was panentheistic, where the world was in God. In other words, the cosmos is kind of God's body. And so the incarnation, the story of Jesus, God becoming flesh, the Word becoming flesh, isn't so unusual when you think of the whole cosmos as kind of an emanation of God's wish. And, and so that's kind of what I experience God to be today. I experience God as a presence. I still very much worship a Christian God. But I recognize that, you know, it's the same God of the Muslims, the Hindus, the Jews, any theistic religion, I think, is worshiping the same God, but with different manifestations. And so my experience of God is largely through my understanding of Jesus. And right now, you know, actually, I write and talk a lot about Jesus. I think that somehow he got it spiritually right, and I'd like to be like Jesus when I grow up spiritually. I've emphasized Jesus rather than Christ because what we've made of Jesus is something unearthly. Something we can't touch or experience.
Untouchable, right.
That's what Jesus, the whole story is about the Word becoming flesh,
right.
God's Word becoming flesh in Jesus. And so I like to emphasize that humanity of Jesus, and my attitude is if he can do it, we can do it.
Well, you have raised so many questions, and I'm going to let you know right now, I want to pick up the thread and follow up on questions that you've raised with me and start out the next show with your ministry and activism and talk about some of your other books and talk about things like sexuality as an expression of spirituality, gay people reclaiming their spirituality, and so many gay people have been damaged through their notions of sin, which I believe is just missing the mark, that we're human, that we're not quote-unquote shameful people. Now, I heard you talking about bad thoughts. Isn't that a judgment? What did you mean by
yes,
bad
thoughts? Yes, I was raised in a religion of judgment.
Yes.
If I thought something hurtful, and of course, you know, for me then, sex was still a sin. So if I thought of something lustful, all those possible bad thoughts that one could have.
Yes.
And children are not quite as innocent as they seem. I mean,
I'm
of thinking bad things and doing bad things. And one of the interesting things about my parents was that though they loved our independence and encouraged us to pursue our own lives, they nonetheless corrected us. And I remember being made to apologize to teachers. My mom would say, "You have to apologize to Mrs. So-and-so for rolling your eyes at her when you got a patient."
Oh, boy.
And,
yeah,
and so,
right.
And that was hard. That is really hard to apologize, to ask somebody to forgive you. But that's the way I was raised, and I think that's a good thing. I think that helping each other correct our misbehavior is a good thing. It's a spiritual thing.
Well, I hear where you're coming from. What I've discovered is that I've been very hard on myself for a variety of reasons. First, because I was gay, then because I was an addict, quote-unquote addict. I prefer to look at everything as all good because it's all part of what shaped David today. And today I love David. I am a child of God, as we all are, no better or worse than anybody else. And whenever I judge something as bad, I'm going back into my shame. So I prefer to look at it as dysfunctional. It was dysfunctional because it took me into my shame. I've heard people say life is good, and I used to wonder, what do you mean? Life's unfair. Bad things happen. Evil things happen. And yet that, to me, is part of the mystery that is so hard to wrap my human mind around. And today, I'm beginning to get a larger perspective. And, you know, I was also struck by what you said about how you feel like you don't know God as well anymore. And I really want to have a personal discussion with you. I was at that point in my life. Today I have a very intimate experience with God. And I have a great understanding of him, and I would welcome the opportunity to dialogue with you about that off air.
Let's talk about that now for a moment, because I didn't mean to mislead you. My relationship with God, I feel to be more intimate than ever. But I have written and said a number of times that the less I believe, the more faith is required.
Yes,
I
agree.
It's so easy to have a structure on which to place, you know, one's faith. And that's what I think happens with a lot of religious people. They look to religion as the structure, and the more complicated, the better, because the more likely to stand, you know, when the hurricane comes through. But for me, I have been taking it apart piece by piece and realizing, you know, I don't really need this. I don't need that. In fact, this is getting in the way. I got to let go of that. And so it's a process of elimination. It's like one of my blogs was entitled Spiritual Picasso, because Picasso, toward the end of his life, minimalized his rendering of objects by using fewer and fewer lines. And
I like
think
that's
a spiritual ideal, is by eliminating, you know, doctrines and dogmas and et cetera, you really get the essence of God. You can experience the essence of God. So I really feel like I have a more intimate relationship with God, but less things are necessary to keep that in place. And I do want to say something about your substitution of dysfunction for sin, which is, I think, a good choice. Eckhart Tolle talks about that. He says, if the word sin bothers you, substitute unconsciousness or, you know, et cetera, et cetera.
Yes.
And I think that's wise. I do, however, think that there are bad things. But I want to say what I said at the beginning of the program. I said something about, I was quoting Paul in Romans, of all places, all things work together for good for those who love God, who are called according to God's purpose. And
okay.
In that very passage, he talks about the sufferings that we endure, but that shapes us into who we are. And
yes.
So it's not saying that the suffering isn't there, the fact that you were molested as a child. That's going to always be there, but it has contributed somehow. You have responded to it in such a way that you have made something good out of something that is really bad. And
yeah,
and
I hear you.
That's what the person of faith is able to do, because we have a context of meaning, and even the person without faith has a context of meaning into which to understand, by which to understand all the events of one's life. Henry Nouwen said that, you know, when we give God thanks for our life, we generally mean thanks for the good things, but we also have to thank God for the bad things that transformed us, that shaped us and gave us a calling, perhaps, a ministry. And one of his great quotes is, when we are crushed like grapes, who knows what wine we will become.
Oh, I
when
love that.
When you're crushed like grapes, who knows what wine we may become. And I really believe that. That's what I've experienced in my life. Though I despaired the Presbyterian Church taking so long to approve ordination of LGBT people, to approve same-sex marriages, and it's not going to benefit me. I mean, I'm retired, and so I'll never be part of the Presbyterian pension program. Only for 10 years earned a salary in the Presbyterian Church when I did the Lazarus Project, the Ministry of Reconciliation. I made my living by writing books and doing speaking things, and now a little bit comes in for the blog. But it's been nonetheless, though not financially rewarding, spiritually fulfilling for me to pursue this call to ministry that I feel God gave me. And so, I kind of rumble a little bit inside about, well, why couldn't they do this? and it's pointing me. I mean, one of the reasons I was ordained in MCC was that I always had any congregation that would call me in as a minister, I would join, and I would get credentialed in their denomination. And so MCC asked me to do an interim at a church here in Atlanta, and I felt like that church deserved someone who was fully credentialed. And so I went through the process of transitioning, and at the time, and still, MCC allows for dual affiliation. So I'm still a Presbyterian, but I'm also an MCC minister. Not sure how the Presbyterians feel about that, but that doesn't matter.
Beautiful. Chris, I know you need to go at 4:30. Can you run 3 minutes over?
I guess, sure.
Okay. One thing I wanted to say is that I recently learned that the Aramaic translation from Aramaic of sin is missing the mark. And I think that that is so much more comforting than what I had perceived as sin. And what I also wanted to do is just let people know what is coming up on my upcoming episodes. And I want to pick up the thread here, Chris, and I will review the podcast of this show before we begin our second show, so that I can write down questions that have occurred to me that we don't have time to cover. So I just want to let people know, tomorrow I have an up-and-coming country musician who's a New Thought musician by the name of Stephen Graves, and you will be able to hear two of his songs. And Chris, if you need to go, I thank you for being with us. I'm just going to let the audience know what's upcoming. Thank you so much for honoring us today.
Let me say goodbye, and again, invite people to go to my blog. It's free. It's ad-free. It's http thrisgler.blogspot.com. Or just Google my name. You'll find it. And there's almost 200 posts now. I've been doing this since 2011 weekly on Wednesdays. And subscription is free, too, by the way. So, because I didn't want ads to meet people. So thank you, David, so much. It's been a pleasure. And I'll see you.
Likewise. Yep. And I would love to talk to you off air before the next show, if you're open to that.
Oh, of course.
Beautiful. Okay. Thanks again, Chris.
Thanks,
so
David.
Who else is, you're welcome. Who else is coming up? First of all, I want to let you know I'm going to be a guest on the Hollis Chapman Show on Friday morning at 10:30. Just go to blogtalkradio.com and look, search out Hollis Chapman. That's H-O-L-L-I-S, Chapman, spelled just like it sounds. The psychic Mary Blake, who is also a radio show host and who is co-authoring a book with me called Awaken to Your Spirit, will be on immediately preceding my interview. And as I mentioned, Chris Glaser will return on either July 30th or July 31st. His understanding is July 31st, and I will honor that. And if that is indeed the date, the show will be Friday, July 31st at 7:30 Eastern Time. So with that said, I would like to thank all of those who have listened today. I hope that you meditate upon the wonderfully spiritual food that we have received from a wonderful man of God. And just to remind you to consider this, that God is in each of us as we are in God. Therefore, we are God. We can be perfect. Jesus was just a man. I believe he would be horrified if people, as have some done, turned him into a deity. He was just a man. I do not believe he was seeking to establish a religion. And I think that his point was that we are all children of God, no better or worse than anybody else, that we all share the same potential. And as he said in John, the book of John, even greater works than these you shall do. Now, if you believe in miracles, that means that each and every one of you will be able to work miracles greater than Jesus did. And if you believe in the literal interpretation of his miracles, as I do, can you imagine what your potential is? If you accept that Jesus was perfect, except that he was afraid to die on the cross, and he says that we can be even greater than him, can you imagine being perfect yourself? Think about that. Ponder that in your heart. So once again, we come to a close. Now we can pause and reflect upon the idea that we are all united through the diverse tapestry of our individual gifts. There is no real thing of separation except in our own minds. We are each unique expressions of the ultimate source of our beings. We are spiritual beings having a human experience who are having a spiritual experience. Have a great week, and remember, whatever you dream, you can realize.
You have been listening to Different Strokes for Different Folks. To find common ground and take it to the next level, here on Blog Talk Radio with David Clark, every Friday at 7:30 p.m. Eastern. You can listen to this broadcast again on srbroadcasting.com.